This episode is sponsored by the upcoming release movie, Tin Soldier. When retired soldier Nash Kavanagh, played by Scott Eastwood, is pulled into a government operation to help bring down a cult-like group, his motivations in agreeing are not entirely selfless. What started as a group to help ex-soldiers recover from PTSD has morphed into a dangerous movement in which the leader, Bokushi, played by Academy Award winner Jamie Foxx, is building his own army of mind-controlled mercenaries. Nash knows all too well what a risk the group poses, because he was once one of them. And his wife, Everly, played by Nora Onizeda, remains under Bokushi's control. Also starring Robert De Niro as a CIA operative, Tin Soldier tracks Nash's last-ditch effort to save his wife and stop the Bokushi, all while navigating government secrets that threaten to destabilize everything. Tin Soldier opens in cinemas in South Africa on Friday, the 8th of August, 2025, and it's a must-see. Welcome to True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to a review of the Showmax original, The ABC Killer, and an interview with director Jason Howes. If you're a true crime content consumer in South Africa, I probably don't need to tell you who Moses Sithole is, although I'll tell you just in case. A tagline to the new Showmax original series about his crimes describes him as South Africa's Ted Bundy. And although I get why they say that, I think Ted Bundy might be America's Moses Sithole. Yes, I know Bundy came first, but South Africa's serial killer landscape is just so different from America's that I do think there's little comparison. Moses Sithole committed his crimes in a time in South Africa when there was a huge uptick in serial killers. More on why later. He would eventually be convicted on 38 murders, 40 rapes, and 6 robberies, and become one of the most prolific serial killers in the country's modern history. I covered the case way back in episode 9 of the podcast. Since then, I've received a huge amount of feedback on Moses, and some anecdotes from people who've met him or had some form of contact with him through their work. I'll share some of those stories toward the end of this episode. Over the years, there have been a few other pieces of content created around his crimes. Podcasts, YouTube videos, and he's been included in a book or two. If you know the podcast, then you know that I'm not one for the creation of true crime content just for the sake of it, especially when that content brings nothing new. So I will admit, I was interested to see that Showmax's latest original crime series was about Sithole, and a little concerned that it might just be a rehashing of the life and times of the perpetrator with little concern for his victims. But I needn't have worried. In fact, the series, which is on the Showmax app for you to watch right now, actually introduced me to elements of this case I didn't know existed, which is no mean feat when you've spent the last 6 years of your life solely dedicated to true crime. Most importantly for me, as someone who tries to produce victim-centered true crime content, the series does not gloss over the victim's experience. In fact, it brings it right up front and ensures you can never forget that at least 38 women lost their lives to this man, and at least one woman has lived most of her life dealing with the trauma of his violence against her. I'm going to do my best not to spoil any of the stuff that made my jaw drop in this series, but in my discussion with director Jason Howes, I do touch on some aspects of the content. This is Jason's second crime series production. His last was another Showmax original about the crimes of Stuart Wilkin. This series, Booty Boot, Inside the Mind of a Monster, which is still up on the Showmax app as well. And that too was an incredible piece of work, which was nominated for a SAFTA award. Jason is an experienced and talented storyteller in film. And although he's told many human stories, true crime hasn't featured a lot in his work. But he clearly has a talent for the genre. As is so often the case in the genre, one case leads you on to another. And Jason started delving into Moses Sotole while he was working on the Stuart Wilkin series. And with two serial killer series now under his belt, I asked Jason whether he thought he'd developed a bit of a thing for serial killers.
It's something that I'm exploring at the moment. I don't think it's something that I would continue to do, like, you know, until the end of time, but I had an interest in it. And there were a couple cases that, you know, it started with Booty Boot, and that was the first case that I was genuinely solidly interested in and researched for many years. And then that was a natural progression into the Moses Sotole case because of, you know, what had happened during my research phase and people I'd met. So it was very organic. And now I find myself, there is one more that I'd like to do that I think is very interesting and has got like very fascinating cultural aspects to it that I think makes it very unique and makes it different to anything we've seen before in terms of that particular angle into the story. And so I'm willing to put a bit of time and effort behind. But beyond that, I don't know. I think I might be focusing on other types of content. Stuff is not the easiest to digest at times, and it does linger. So I don't know if I want to be doing it, you know, like all the time. But they remain very fascinating people, and they're an interesting sort of look into the human condition, as it were, and what drives the choices we make, what makes us who we are, why do some of us have this in us, have this ability to, you know, to do these heinous things. It is interesting, and I think it's worth discussing and exploring, and I think it's what makes, I think it's the ultimate true crime. Serial killers are such interesting people. I think it's a difficult subject to sort of depict because you're kind of having to really be careful about not being too grotesque, and you don't want to be exploitative. You don't want to take advantage of this narrative in that way. But at the same token, you have a responsibility to depict these people for who and what they were, because any softening of that, I feel, is unjust against those that lost, you know. That it's like they went through the absolute hell of the experience. To soften it too much is almost, it's almost devaluing their experience. So it's a fine line that we straddle, and so far I've managed to get away with what I've done. But yeah, each narrative gets darker and darker, so let's see where we end up.
You heard Jason mention in there about people he'd met while working on the Booty Boot series, which had led him to Moses Sotole's case. One of those people was Tamsin De Beer. If you've listened to the episode I did on this case, you might remember Tamsin as the young journalist who started communicating with Moses while he was still active in his series. He'd called into the Star newspaper one evening while Tamsin was on duty, and that started an ongoing series of calls, which would eventually lead Tamsin to trying to help police to catch Sotole. When I covered the case originally, I did mention Tamsin and even included a sound clip of a statement she'd made. But watching the ABC killer, I realized how little I'd actually understood her role in this case, and also the very interesting psychological journey she went through as a result. Jason and his team also do an incredible job of using the young cub reporter's own life at the time to contrast against what was happening in South Africa and how different the victim's lived experience was. In the mid-1990s, when Moses was most active, the country was just shifting away from apartheid and into a democratic society. Understandably, there were significant teething pains as the country as a whole learned how to be a place where everyone had the same rights, and where crime was concerned, the SAPS, learned how to adjust to now being a service for all people instead of a force often harnessed against the majority. The ABC Killer series highlights this very well, and also how serial killers moved unseen within this chaos. Here's Jason's thoughts on depicting that in the series.
Yeah, it was a very strange time, you know, like we mentioned in the documentary that it was in that window period where we'd become this democracy and there'd been this like overnight change in the way our society works, but we didn't have a constitution in place yet. Our police force had just changed into a police service and their mandate completely changed as well. So it was ripe for this type of activity. And there was certainly a spike in violent criminal activity, whether it was cash and transit heists, whether it was serial murder and gender-based violence. Like it happened so fast that a lot of people just didn't actually know what to do with it. Mm. You know, they were almost lost in this freedom or this democracy a little bit. So everyone was trying to find their feet. And that's why during that time, it appeared as a lot of lawlessness. It really just appeared that way. But I mean, what an interesting time, but a difficult time as well.
As I've said before, South African serial killers, and really all crime, is very much unique to the country, and sometimes even the province it's happening in. All the cultural, socioeconomic, and political aspects of a region feed into how crimes are committed. So the serial killer profile in the United States, for instance, is not the same as it is in South Africa. Through his exploration of Sithole, Jason discovered this too.
Just to add to that, or just to link that to that particular period in South Africa's history, and in both my series that I've made, I talk about a former FBI agent who was sort of like the godfather of the serial killer investigation, sort of building that whole sort of idea of serial killers as a phenomenon, Robert Ressler. And he came to South Africa during that time to assist with building a profile, right? And we talk about this in the series, and his profile was completely incorrect because he was coming at it from this perspective of what he had seen in the American landscape. And even as simple as something as like in the American landscape, it was plausible that many of the serial killers could move around with their own vehicle. They had the buying power to have their own transport, or they would utilize public transport because there was a public transport network that was quite robust. But in South Africa, it wasn't like that at all. So you couldn't apply that thinking. Largely, everything is done on foot. People don't have that much expendable income, etc. It's all these culturally specific and country specific elements that make South Africa as a landscape for this kind of phenomenon so unique. And we saw that there, where somebody from America tried to apply what they understood about the way these guys work, and he was completely wrong.
I will tell you that even though this phenomenon of country-specific crime behavior is more widely understood now, I did have a conversation the other day with a whole professor of criminology at a university in the United States, who was completely mind-blown when I explained how different South African serial killers are to theirs. She had no idea that criminal behavior varied from country to country. In a way, this period in time was beneficial to our crime-fighting skills in the long run, because it forced us to get really good at catching serial killers.
100%. Yeah, I mean, the groundwork that was done by people like Mickey Pistorius and other members of the murder and robbery units and stuff like that, as it were, remarkable work that was done there. You know, the adoption of new ways of processing forensic evidence and DNA evidence, et cetera, you know, we were very much blazing a trail and very up for it. And, you know, it's so nice to be able to speak to some of these people that were around at that time and have them share their experiences, because these were unsung heroes, people that like no one really knew who they were, but they were the behind the scenes actually doing the good work. And at that point in time, you know, we had a lot to prove. I think in the new series, in the ABC Killer, it's so nice to show that, well, one, there was doubt from society. Even Mandela himself was doubtful that this team of investigators were actually going to solve this crime. He said it to one of the guys. He was like, I don't know if you're going to find this guy. But obviously he was happily surprised, and they were up to the task, right? And they worked together, and they showed that they could serve the people, because they needed to prove that to the people of this country, especially these vulnerable African women that were largely feeling very isolated and very much the sort of target. There's some wonderful coverage in the news and stuff like that. People being interviewed in the streets, women being interviewed in the streets about how they feel. And it's great that, like, I always use this as like an analogy, but if the Rugby World Cup was Mandela's way of bringing people together behind a common cause, the people of South Africa, this behind this euphoric opportunity, this moment in time that could really unite us. This particular case did the same for our police service. It was a good cause to get behind, and it was a good reason to work together. And they did. They did work together, and it's, you know, we see the result of that.
You heard Jason talk about some unsung heroes there. And this was another element of this case that surprised me in the series. I've delved into a ton of resources about this case, and none of them mentioned the black police officers that were so closely involved in the investigation. Jason says that as soon as he started talking to some of the investigators all these years later, they were quick to acknowledge all of their colleagues who'd been involved.
Yeah, well, I mean, that comes down to actually having to speak to some of the white investigators. And they were very forthcoming in saying, listen, speak to these people. Frans Fanikak, he who was also pivotal to this investigation and a very, very, very good investigator, he was very open and honest about saying, listen, we have to speak to Paul Nkomi. Mm-hmm. Like, Paul did incredible detective work to track down the identity of Moses Sithole. And I was so grateful to get Paul involved. You know, there were a couple other people that I wanted to speak to that actually declined for some reason. And then obviously there was a couple that also had passed away. But I was very grateful to have Paul involved because, you know, he, not besides being a wonderful person and having some great little one-liners that he gave me in his interview, he also could reflect a bit on the experience of having been a young police officer during the apartheid regime and what his hope and dream was, you know, in terms of what he wanted to do with his career. And he wanted to be a murder and robbery investigator. That's what he wanted to do. He wanted to solve important crimes. And he, as much as the white cops, he had a lot to prove. He spoke very openly about the fact that he went from being what his community saw as someone that's working for the enemy to now being somebody that's supposedly working for us, but having to prove that to his community. And as a black person, in a way, this case came at the opportune moment to actually be like, you know what? We are who we say we are now. And just so grateful that he got a bit of limelight and was available to share his side of the story.
If you've read my book, Sizzlers, you'll have read about the experience of that investigating officer, now retired Captain Jonathan Morris, who, as a young coloured man, joined the SAPS during apartheid. He details incredibly shocking treatments that officers who were people of colour received at that time. And I can honestly say that any officer who lasted through that and went on to build a career in the SAPS was undoubtedly there for the right reasons. It was also clear to me that this case was still really important to all of the investigators that worked it, even 31 years later.
If I think about, like, you know, Vinyl Fulyun comes to mind, and my time with Vinyl was very touching. I believe this genuinely, that he truly just wanted to serve his community. Like, that was his life's purpose. And it brought such a sense of, like, meaning and purpose to his life. And you can see, I mean, obviously he's got a lot of PTSD, but you can see how emotional he gets when he talks about certain moments in the narrative that really stuck with him for a lifetime. And that still bring him to almost tears, just thinking about the difference that was made, you know, the hard work and the payoff. Just being able to say to the ANC Women's League, we're going to solve this crime, we are going to protect these women, and to see their relation when Moses is actually brought to justice. It's very heartwarming, very emotional. I got a lot of love and a lot of time for these people that I've been privileged to meet in this process. I just think they're so inspiring.
So, small spoiler alert, but there's a moment in the series where Vinyl Fulyun stands in the same courtroom where Moses was sentenced. And it's almost as though he forgets that the cameras are there, as he becomes completely absorbed in his memories. It's clearly an emotional moment for him, and the scene is powerful. Thinking about what happened there and how much pain was contained in that room, how the hopes for healing of so many family members were pinned on the outcome of that trial, you can almost picture the scene as it must have been that day. Something similar happened for me when Jason and his team interviewed a survivor of Moses Sithole on screen. From my podcast on the case, you might remember Buyiswa Swagamisu. She was the first victim that Moses was convicted of raping, long before he appears to have started his series of murders. She essentially secured her own justice by spotting Moses in the street and calling a police officer. Then she was forced to suffer the indignity and incredible trauma of driving to the police station in the back of the police van with Moses. I was so happy to see Buyiswa included in the series. And it was another moment for me where I felt as though the essence of all the women who hadn't made it, whose lives had been taken by Sithole, were there in the room supporting her. I asked Jason about his decision to include Buyiswa.
There were so many victims, and I suppose trying to track down all of them was impossible. So when I was able to find Buyiswa, it made sense that she almost became the embodiment of all of the victims' experience. I think the fact that she is largely the sort of motivating reason for him going out and doing what he did, or at least according to him, she was the perfect person to feature and hone in on. And her story is just so remarkable as well. Yeah. I mean, I think it really enriched it. And I'm so glad that she agreed. You know, she never didn't want to not do it. She was reluctant. I think once she met me and she saw the crew and everyone, and I think she realized, because initially she wanted to be kept anonymous, so we would have to shoot her in a silhouette and all that kind of stuff. And we were happy to do so, and we were preparing to do so, even on the shoot day when we arrived at her place. And then something changed, and she decided, you know what, I'm not going to hide away, I'm going to speak my truth. And she just felt so empowered, and I think we were just so lucky and so blessed to have her feel confident enough to put herself out there.
I said to Jason that I think that it's a testament to him and his team. It's not easy to gain the trust of a survivor of this kind of trauma. And as you'll learn in the series, Buyiswa's trauma did not end with Moses being incarcerated, the first or the second time. She experienced terrible treatment from her own husband and community after the rape, and when Sithole later claimed that she was the whole reason he'd started killing, which, as we know, is incredibly common for sexually motivated serial killers because they have to pin the blame somewhere externally, there were certainly sidelong glances at her then too. What Jason says about her feeling empowered once she started actually telling her story is something that I've found time and time again as well. There's something about the power of a survivor having control over their own story and how they want to tell it that can be incredibly healing.
Absolutely. It's like a form of catharsis. You know, they're able to process it, even if it's years later. There's an element of processing it, sharing that story, speaking truth to power. And I think in many of the cases, I found that in both of these stories that I've told so far, because of the communities that this is happening in, and sort of cultural nuances that exist within those communities, and sort of ideals around, you know, traditional ways of thinking, etc. When something like this happens, say a violent crime of a sexual nature, gender-based violence, etc., there's a lot of shame that comes with that, and there's a lot of often what happens is families can become quite. There can be an element of disconnection, relationships can fall apart, some people can be ostracized. And without being able to actually speak their truth in this way, they just get labeled a certain thing. Like in the case of Buyiswa, like she speaks about when she came home to tell her husband what happened to her, he turned around and blamed her and beat her. Because in the traditional sense, there must have been something that the woman did to provoke this in some way, right? And then she lives with that shame. Mm. And then her in-laws shame her as well. And it just becomes a lifelong struggle of having not only your dignity taken from you, but also in a way your own identity. And you start being labeled something that you're absolutely not because of these traditional mindsets and these conservative mindsets. So I think, again, we give them a platform if they're willing to speak. And I think in many cases, it does help with, you know, healing and coming to terms.
It's really this type of true crime content we need and that I want to see being made in South Africa as we develop the genre in its many forms. Content that centers the victims, brings forward those who were key to solving the crime and not just those who got their names in the articles. And when there is a focus on the offender, it's in a warts and all way, not glorifying or mystifying them. Jason was able to speak with Moses on the phone in preparation for the series. I asked him about that experience.
I had about a 30 or 40 minute conversation with him. I was quite excited to actually speak to him after quite a while of trying to track him down. And so I jumped right in and just asked him some pertinent questions, catching up with where he is today, what's it been like, how does he feel, and then like trying to get into a little bit of the nitty-gritty around motivations and has he deeply reflected on what he's done, et cetera, and does he feel any differently, et cetera. But I think the standout thing for me was that I wanted to get permission, or at least preliminary permission from him to use audio tapes that he had recorded with a psychologist in training who had done a series of interviews with him in 2004 as part of her doctorate, a PhD. And he reluctantly agreed, but he asked me a question. He said, so do you think that if I give you this permission and people hear this stuff or whatever, do you think it's going to change the way society sees me? And I thought that was interesting. Not surprising. I think a lot of the time they do think that after years of being in prison and having gone through what we believe to be rehabilitation and obviously a lot of psychological work that's happened, a lot of them find religion. And then, you know, obviously that is now their salvation. But I had to be quite candid with him and say, I don't think there's a universe where society would see you any differently. I think the extreme nature of your case, of how many people you killed, how many lives you destroyed, is going to render you a monster for the rest of time. And I think you need to accept that. And he was, throughout the entire conversation, was very soft-spoken. I could understand why people would find him so, I don't know, they're charming. So, you know, disarming. He just had this very soft-spoken tone. I recognized his voice immediately when he picked up the phone because I'd obviously heard I'd watched and listened to the tape that he had recorded in prison. And so I knew immediately that that was his voice. But sadly, after that, I never got a chance to speak to him again. He got spooked after that. He kind of avoided me. I think on some level, he started to think and maybe get a bit paranoid as to who I was, what my intentions were. Was I being honest or was I someone that was now trying to get him into more trouble? You know, he has made attempts in the time that he's been in prison to take the prison system itself to court for what he believes was misconduct and mistreatment. Like, for instance, and I think it was in 2012, he made the news where he had taken the prison system to court, the DCS, because of he felt that they mistreated him in moving him far away from his family. So he couldn't see his family. He was moved from the CMAX prison in Pretoria to Mangaung in Bloemfontein. And that created a big distance between him and the little bit of family that he did have. And he's always been kind of vocal. You know, he would always speak out. Even when is a little tidbit that I picked up along the way, but I was working quite closely with the deputy information officer at the SAPS HQ in Pretoria in tracking down dockets. Wonderful person, Colonel Iyer. She is just such a, and she loves true crime. So she was like all up and trying to help me. And I really appreciate her. I got a lot of time for her. I mean, she really gave me like a different experience of the SAPS. Let me say that. And she told me she had a memory when she had just started at the information office, of someone phoning her from prison, and it was Moses Sithole. And he was saying to her, listen, I will be your informant on the inside because there's a lot of things that is wrong here in the prison, and I can give you information. And he's this little kind of whistleblowing mentality that he had, this idea that he had, or that he felt that he had the right to play this role, to exercise his rights, even though he had done so much wrong. And I think that still exists to this day. I mean, from what I understand, I think at the moment in prison, he is quite close to the captain in his particular block, and he helps out with paperwork and stuff like that. So he's quite literate. So he's not only gotten himself educated, he's also made himself quite useful. He's like a bit of an Andy Dufresne if that makes sense to you, in that particular prison. And it's just fascinating. I suppose that's his way of finding meaning, finding purpose, is to continue educating himself and to continue to be of some kind of use. But I think he also does it so he has access to a computer, and so that he can also get online and potentially see what's happening in the outside world. Who knows?
Who knows indeed. Oh, and by the way, in case you don't get the reference, Andy Dufresne is a character from the movie Shawshank Redemption, who is a wrongfully convicted person. He is portrayed as intelligent, quiet, and very honest, although very witty and personable when he wants to be. And yes, those are all qualities that I've heard people associate with Sithole. Okay, maybe not so much the honest part, and definitely not the wrongfully convicted part, but the rest for sure. I'm always intrigued with people's interactions directly with Sithole, because over the years, so many people who've had direct contact with him have approached me with their stories. And I found that there seems to be a significant difference between how he engages with men and women. And that's probably not just something that's specific to him. I'm pretty sure that most heterosexual men would behave differently with women after being incarcerated for many years. But with him, it seems to go deeper than that. And considering he killed at least 38 women, it certainly has a different slant for me. One person who contacted me over the years had been a student doctor doing her internship year at a government hospital. She recalled how one day while she was on shift, the DCS arrived with an incarcerated offender who required treatments they couldn't offer within the facility he was being held in. She was used to treating prisoners, and for the most part, hadn't had any difficult scenarios arise from those patients. That was until a particular man was shuffled into her treatment room. She explained how her back was facing the man as he was brought in and settled into a chair. She could hear the metal of his leg chains and handcuffs clanking as he moved. Again, that wasn't strange. Many offenders were brought in like that for safety reasons. But, she says, as she quickly finished up the chart she'd been writing up for the previous patient, a strange feeling settled over her. Her stomach tightened, and the hairs on her arms stood on end. She couldn't understand what her body might be reacting to until she turned around and found herself looking into the eyes of the man sitting in the shackles on the chair in her office. He said nothing, but she was struck by the darkness of his eyes and then a strange smile that moved across his lips. Quickly reclaiming her professionalism, she proceeded to complete the patient's treatments and he left. Later, she looked at his name on the file. Moses Sithole. When this woman reached out to me, she explained that she'd never had an experience like this before or after that day. And she still had no proper explanation for why her body had reacted that way to the man's presence. A scientist She tried to convince herself that it was just that creepy noise of the shackles and the knowledge that he was a prisoner that had done it. Or maybe she'd been coming down with something and her body was fighting it off. Maybe. Maybe not. Another woman reached out to me with her own Sithole tale. She'd been volunteering with a charity who helped to set up libraries in prisons for offenders. There was one very helpful and polite man who went out of his way to help her with her tasks, like stacking books or dusting. Unlike the doctor, this woman had no physical reaction to the man's presence. In fact, she thought he was very nice and briefly wondered what he might be incarcerated for. After a few interactions, though, she started to notice that the other male offenders would always hang around close by whenever this particular man was in the library with her. Even if they'd finished their business in the library, she noticed one would not leave until another had entered. She was never left alone with her helpful volunteer. Then, one day, she was pulled aside by one of the offenders. He asked if she knew who the man was that was so keen to help her. She didn't, of course, but her mouth gaped as he explained the truth. Her smiling, polite, up-for-anything helper had murdered 38 women. The man told her that she needed to be very careful around him. It wasn't so much that anyone thought he might become violent toward her, but he may become a little too attached. And he knew of other women who'd had bad experiences with Sithole after that happened. This statement rings true for me when I consider some of the other stories I've heard. Take Charmaine, for instance, who became Sithole's pen pal after visiting him in prison as part of a volunteer group. I interviewed her on the podcast directly after I covered this case. It started out as curiosity on her part more than anything. She wanted to know what a man who could commit the atrocities Moses had was like, and things were okay in the beginning. But soon, Sithole became a little too attached. He started sending Charmaine what were essentially love letters, completely leapfrogging their relationship from friendship to a love affair, without Charmaine's consent or any indication from her that she was interested in that. Charmaine was understandably horrified and immediately stopped communicating with him. And then there is renowned author Angela Makolwa. I mentioned Angela briefly in the original episode, and then in 2024, I would get the honour of meeting and interviewing her at the Franschhoek Literary Festival. Many years ago, Angela had also been fascinated by Sithole's story, and she was interested in the possibility of writing a book about him and his crimes. She started visiting Moses in prison, and he was very keen for her to write such a book, at least in the beginning. Quickly, though, Sithole became far too attentive toward Angela, and instead of writing letters that would help her to write the book, he focused solely on the idea that they were in some sort of relationship together. Time and again, Angela tried to steer Sithole away from this idea, explaining that she was not interested in him like that and she was only there for the project. But he became more and more intense. Eventually, letters were arriving at her home almost every single day. He was phoning her every time he got the opportunity to access the phone. And besides this frightening and bizarre behaviour, Moses was clearly also not interested in having a factual and balanced book written. He wanted to control the narrative. He wanted Angela to write what he told her to write. Right down to his misogynistic views of women And his claims that his crimes had been a way to teach women that they could not, quote, mess with men and get away with it. Angela ceased all communication with Moses Sithole. When she spoke to him for the last time and told him she would not be proceeding with the project, she got a glimpse of the man behind the mask. He was furious. Angela didn't entirely abandon the project, though. She ended up turning it into a fictional tale called Red Ink, which was published in 2007. It made her one of the first black crime fiction writers in South Africa and started a love for the genre, which has since produced many more books. Angela doesn't really like talking about Moses anymore. She says he's not the reason she does what she does today. She doesn't want him to be given credit that he doesn't deserve. But she acknowledges that meeting him played a pivotal role in her life. When I interviewed her, we agreed beforehand that she would speak about him generally, but to pay homage to his victims, we would not name him. And that's exactly what we did. And honestly, after all the stories I've heard about this man, I think that would have annoyed him the most. Angela admits that she still feels an element of traumatization from that experience. She feels that she came very close to seeing the man that his victims saw in their last moments. And that is something she'll never forget. In the series The ABC Killer, a psychologist, Dr. Gia Del Fabbro, who interviewed Sithole in prison for her PhD, speaks about her experience with him. I was interested to see this because I know of at least one other psychologist, a man, who made the same request to Sithole not long before he agreed to speak with Del Fabbro. The male psychologist was less successful. He was strung along by Sithole for quite some time, and he felt that the roles were being reversed, and he was being interviewed by Sithole more than the other way around. Jason mentioned how Moses was very interested in how the public would see him as a result of the series, and this is something that came up in discussions between this male psychologist and Sithole too. Sithole eventually sent the psychologist a message through his lawyer a day before the interview was going to be held, saying that he'd chosen not to participate. So much of serial murderer behavior is based on power and control, especially when the crimes are sexually motivated. Sithole's crime scenes and his MO clearly show that desire for control over the women he killed. And two things jump out at me from the stories I've heard, and even his interaction with Jason. Where women are concerned, Sithole does not understand consent and boundaries. He very quickly leaps from initial meeting to pseudo-relationship behavior in his mind. That is classic sexual predator behavior. And the other thing is that despite being behind bars, in any way he can, Moses Sithole continues to seek ways to control others and hold power over them. He can't do that physically anymore, but he can do it by withholding contact or accelerating contact. He does it by weaponizing the system and suing the DCS, and even in my opinion, by becoming the helpful offender in prison who's close to those in power. In short, and of course this is just my opinion, Moses Sithole is not, nor will he ever likely be, rehabilitated. If Sithole was hoping that the ABC Killer series would put him in a favourable light with the public, he'll be disappointed. And rightly so. Instead, the series brings to light the true damage that his actions wrought on his victims' families, the women who survived his brutal attacks, and countless others who ended up in his orbit. I am incredibly impressed by this series, and truly happy to see more of this type of quality true crime content coming out of South Africa. All three episodes of The ABC Killer are up on Showmax right now, and I highly recommend you check it out. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.